Hello everyone, and thanks for joining us on another episode of the Zerodha Educate podcast. My name is Prateek Singh and I'm the CEO and founder of LearnApp.com. If you want to learn anything about investing or trading, do visit LearnApp.com. So we started recording this series just as the Indian market started to fall, and the idea was to bring a sane and actionable perspective from the best in the markets. And today we have an amazing guest with us. I'm talking to Radhika Gupta, the CEO of Edelweiss Mutual Fund. Now, Radhika started her career with McKinsey and later joined AQR. That's a pioneer quant research firm. She then started her own hedge fund, which was acquired by Edelweiss Financial Services in 2014. She also led the acquisitions of JP Morgan Mutual Fund and Ambit's AIF business and became the CEO of Edelweiss Mutual Fund. In this wide-ranging conversation, we talk about investor behavior. We also dive deep into asset allocation, a topic which perplexes a lot of investors. Please enjoy my conversation with Radhika Gupta of Edelweiss Mutual Fund. Hi, everyone. Today we have Radhika Gupta with us, the CEO of Edelweiss AMC. Thank you for doing this with us, Radhika.
Thank you so much for having me.
Perfect. So let's begin with the intro. I actually didn't know that you worked at AQR, and AQR is like one of the most interesting hedge funds out there, right? So tell me about your experience with Cliff Asnis and he's one of the smartest investors of all time. What was your experience there?
So he's also one of the coolest hedge fund or financial services professionals of all time, by the way. If you watch and see his Twitter feed, it's just incredible. I highly recommend you follow him on Twitter. He's just fantastic. He's so open-minded and so blunt. And that's how he is in real life. I joined AQR in 2006, actually, when it was reasonably young. You know, they've had interesting origins because they started and then went through an immediate crisis. Yeah. I joined at a high point, which was 2006. And then, for those of you who followed financial history, the quant crisis of 2007 happened. And when I joined AQR, they were a 40 billion firm. They became 20 billion after the quant crisis. But the amazing thing about AQR is that it is resilient as hell. So I went back to meet Cliff 2 years ago, exactly 10 years after I had left the firm. And they're 200 billion now, Prateek. So they're one of those firms that's really found their zone, bounced back after the crisis. What I loved about AQR is that it was kind of like being in college because it has such a learning environment. And then it's like working for a real life hedge fund. I mean, at that point in time, we had speakers like Nassim Taleb come speak to us as analysts just for regular learning sessions live. And we obviously realized or didn't realize how big a deal that was. It was an amazing environment.
It's interesting. So what I understand of AQR, obviously a lot of people don't understand how the company works, right? Because it's just the world of hedge funds. So I'm curious to know, since everything is so quant driven and apparently they've done so well over the years, do you bring any of that quant framework, that any of that mindset comes down to like how Edelweiss AMC functions today?
It does. It always has. And, you know, there is a whole suite of products within Edelweiss AMC, and we can talk about them. That's very, very model driven. For instance, the whole Balanced Advantage Fund, the Equity Savings Fund, they are entirely process driven funds. Actually, the Large Cap Fund, the Arbitrage Fund. So we are one of those firms where if you look at our investment team, we're divided into three parts. There's a long-only equity team, which does your classic equity fundamental stuff. There's a fixed income team. And then there's a third team called hybrid, which manages some of these middle funds. And it follows, you know, I think a very similar approach, because I do believe that the guy who's managing a balanced fund and that decision to do equity versus debt, etc., is not the same DNA as the guy managing a long-only fund. So we do actually put that in place.
So that's interesting. We'll talk about that. I'm really curious to understand how that actually works, like the math behind the balanced advantage. So we'll talk about that somewhere in the mid of this podcast. But for now, since you've been involved in financial markets for decades now, compare 2008 ka crisis with the crisis we have right now. I'm guessing 50-60% of the audience has never seen a crisis before, and they're probably investing for the first time, right? You also started your AMC, your asset management company, in 2008, which is the worst time to do it, right, from a business perspective. So tell us about that.
So I think for the audience, by the way, that has just started investing after 2008, while you're probably hating what you're going through right now, I do want to tell you that you will be really happy about this experience, because markets go through this kind of stuff. I mean, Taleb wrote the book, The Black Swan, and I do believe that things like this, I hope it's not COVID again, but things like this will happen every 7 to 10 years, where all your assumptions and all your state of normalcy and everything is challenged. You see these circuits, the news is crazy, oil prices are under 20, I mean, all this stuff will happen again. And you need to go through it as an investor. I always tell young analysts, Pratik, in my firm, that you need to see a cycle. I mean, that's a very common thing. Like, I've seen a cycle. I think investors need to see a cycle. And I think for investors who haven't gone through 2008, this is your cycle. In fact, a couple of guys in my office have been saying that. As far as 2008 is concerned, I mean, on a lighter note, I think every crisis is different. My husband and I both worked on Wall Street then, and we were joking that 2008 was so rough on us that we almost never came home. I mean, we slept many nights in the office. And then you have this crisis, you can't even physically go to office. So clearly the color and kind of crisis has changed. But I think there are similarities. Obviously, this is a health crisis, and I think our systems and us as a DNA, we can predict a bank failure, or not predict, but we can understand a bank failure. We can analyze it. Yes. Something like COVID is a lot harder for us to analyze. And as I said, I think the human impacts of it, right now people's concern is health first. Even governments, their concern is health first and reviving the economy later. So I think that's how it's different. But what is common is obviously the fact that a lot of assumptions are tested in both crises. So in 2008, I remember sitting on the investment desk, and suddenly the risk guy would come and say, don't trade with this broker. We think he's going to go bust. And I mean, you've seen that. You've seen banks nearly on the verge of failure. So those kind of extraordinary things are, I think, common to both crises. Assumptions completely going haywire. I think that element is common. The element of investor fear is common. The way debt markets are moving is common. So a lot of that basic, you know, nuance of a crisis is very common.
Right. So you've talked about what's common, right? But here's, I needed your perspective on this. Even in 2008, businesses didn't shut, right? I mean, some businesses, I'm not saying all, but a lot of businesses have stopped. They're just not in business anymore. So what's your view on very particularly the companies in India over this lockdown period? Is it greatly exaggerated in the media, or should we really be concerned, because a lot of businesses are just not in business?
No, I don't think it's exaggerated, and I think it is not fully understood, and it can't be fully understood for the simple reason that you don't even know how long the lockdown is going to last. Right? You know, will it end on April 14th? Will it end in permanence on April 14th, or will it continue for a while? There are a lot of businesses that are completely shut down. I think, you know, the head of PBR was having a conversation with CNBC. I mean, look at those industries, and they are high risk, high capital industries. There are also a lot of businesses that are working in our essential services where employees are not able to come to office for whatever reason. I was talking to the head of a large shipping franchise a few days ago, and he was talking about the facts that it's difficult for trucks to ply in some parts of India. So the logistical challenges, you know, you just announced a lockdown 20 days ago. And for a country of 1 billion people to work normally, even in essential services after that, is very, very difficult. So I think the economic impact, you can't understate. Also remember, and I think to your previous question, however, that whenever there is an economic impact, and this happened in 2008, central banks and governments do step in to help you out. Money comes into the system. And I think that will be common between 2008 and 2020. The world learned that after the First and Second World War, that you can't just sit back and hold money. Banks, governments, I mean, the US has promised sort of unlimited money. It's, and the US is an economy that can do that. But remember that element. So while we look at the crisis element, also look at the other side.
Yeah, that makes sense. I have a question towards how you're actually running the AMC also, right? So I'm guessing you had processes in place which required people to be in the office. When funds need to be deployed, when someone buys units, I'm sure there's a process that needs to be taken place on a PC that's at location in the office. When someone needs a redemption, maybe they send a physical form. So what challenges are you facing in actually deploying fresh funds into the market?
Actually, that's not a problem. You know, for us, and I think for many of my counterparts, we kind of anticipated that this would happen before the lockdown. So a week before the lockdown, 99% of the AMC was working from home. And now 100% of us are working from home. Regulators have given us enough exemptions and consideration during this period that we can do all those functions and meet the compliances while working from home. So we are able to deploy fresh funds. We are able to process redemptions with no delay. All of that seems to be happening just fine. So I think technology really works for us. And I'm happy it's a time for us to test, you know, BCP, this whole word, business continuity planning. Yeah. So far, it's been restricted to a spreadsheet or a document that, yes, I have BCP facilities. Well, BCP has been tested. In fact, a colleague of mine who runs IT yesterday was that BCP is now equal to BAU. So business continuity planning has now become business as usual.
Totally right. I think work from home has become normal for a lot of these companies now. So, the next question is about investor behavior, which actually you talk a lot about. So in the current environment, Radhika, what are some bad things or biases you see that investors do in such an environment? And what should they avoid?
So there is a long list, and perhaps a full podcast would happen on this. I should share a couple. And so the first one, I think, is that it's called anchoring globally. But one of the things that we do is we are very return obsessed. And our expectation of return is very shaped by what has happened in the near term. So in a bull market, everyone is feeling bullish and is convinced that equities are going to deliver 18% plus. In a bear market, we look at the numbers of SIPs and mutual funds. I mean, a journal called me yesterday and said, mutual funds have not delivered anything versus debt over the last 10 years. And I said, yeah, because you're looking at it at the bottom of a market. So looking at recent returns is a very bad idea. It's like me, Prateek, doing a performance appraisal of you in the worst month of the entire financial year and saying that's your whole career.
Yeah, it's or such in a the best bias. Yeah, correct.
Right? It's such a natural bias. But if I do it in your best month or your worst month, I'm doing a very skewed outcome. And I think investors do that. It's not to be blamed because they're also surrounded by a lot of noise and media and WhatsApp and all that stuff. But I really think you have to look at the averages. I think that's one recommendation I have to investors. The second thing that investors do, I think, is what you call hoarding. I mean, we love the power of the crowd in India. Yeah. We just love the power of the crowd. So if everyone is running to buy credit risk funds, we go buy credit risk funds. And if everyone is running to buy small caps, we go buy small caps. And if everyone is running to buy overnight funds, we go buy overnight funds. Not realizing that if everyone is chasing the same thing, there actually might be something wrong with it. In fact, many bubbles in financial services have been created because of this. So I think that's something that investors can avoid. And the third is just this unnecessary desire to take action. We were chatting before this started, and you know, the thing to do nothing, I mean, doing nothing is a very difficult thing to do because you constantly want to act. But this desire that, oh, markets are down, you know, maybe I should switch my small cap fund to a mid cap fund, or maybe I should move my mid cap into debt. This constant desire to be active, and that's human tendency. I mean, you know, they say that even when you play a 15-second ad on YouTube, investors forward it or consumers forward it after 2-3 seconds. So this desire to be active, be a lot more passive in your portfolios, look at them less. Someone asked me how much money I had lost on my personal portfolio. And I said, yeah. I don't know. I don't know the exact, because I don't look at it every week and I shouldn't need to look at it every week.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like trying to buy a house and wondering how much money you can make next week if you sold it. And no one thinks like that for real estate, right? But unfortunately for equity, we try to think how much we can make in a month, in a year. And equity is just a long-term asset class, right?
I mean, you know, honestly, if someone published an NAV of your house every day and circulated that on WhatsApp, you'd be pretty depressed.
Yeah, correct. You know, Radhika, there was this talk about, I think in America, someone was funded to create a long-term stock exchange. I don't know what happened to it, but it sounded like a pretty neat idea that you can't, if you enter, you can't exit before a year. And there's like an extra brokerage they charge if you try to do that. I think if we implemented something like that, that behavior would really change.
Yeah, no, and I think people's lens of long term. I mean, I'm going to give the most inappropriate example that I've talked about in the past. But one of the best asset classes in the world, completely different from money, is of course single malts. I'm not a malt drinker, but well, the process of making a malt, Pratik, I went to Scotland and I saw this, takes about 5 6 days to actually do the mixing of whiskey. Then it sits in a cask, right? And the cask goes through, and while the malt is sitting in the cask, it goes through different conditions and different cellars, and it just goes through a lot. For the first 3 years, that substance in the cask does not classify as whiskey. It is not even legally called whiskey. And it is over 12 to 15 to 18 years that that compounding happens. And they give this beautiful analogy that as whiskey goes through different cycles, it acquires the flavor and experience of the cask. And I think that is investing at many different levels. And that is long-term investing.
That's interesting. I can just imagine you going to Scotland for a holiday away from work and looking at whiskey and thinking about compounding.
Actually took a picture, yeah, of some of this, and there's a fascinating chart of 30-year compounding of whiskey, and you pay a lot exponentially for 18-year-old versus 12-year-old whiskey.
That's amazing.
You
Actually, I remember you writing a letter. About 5 C's of a market correction. Do you remember that? That really stood out about investor behavior. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, so I wrote a letter and I did a talk on this, which is still on YouTube, and it talks about essentially how to create a bubble. And interestingly, that talk was done at the peak of a bull market. I mean, it was done in very early 18. And it talked about the fact that I can create any bubble in India by putting in five elements, because investors fall for these four, five things. Those five elements were one, and now you'll relate them to some of the things that you're seeing in a bear market, because I always think bear market problems are actually created in bull markets and they unravel in bear markets. So I'll run through them for you quickly.
Yes.
The first one was creaminess, which is the thing that, you're getting a little more than normal. So anytime, like in a debt product, you're getting 1-2% more than the risk-free rate, just a little extra.
Yeah.
You just spot. That's just something you love, right? Oh, I'm getting a little extra. There must be some extra arbitrage, something special. So I call that creaminess. The second one is consistency. And we've seen it with this monthly dividend saga in mutual funds. But that 1% a month, like getting the same thing every month, month on month. And I usually believe that if you're getting something above the average rate of interest every month consistently, there's some hidden risk that's going to unravel one
Yeah,
day.
just time.
It's just a matter of time. The third is this one that I love, which is called complexity. Is it, if I sell you a simple story, you won't buy it. But if I wrap it complex product or idea with some narrative, especially a narrative about India, it could be a
Yeah, the growth
narrative
story.
about how, I mean, it's like, in the NSEL scam, the whole narrative was around raw wool arbitrage. Like raw wool, you're a warm country. But that kind of stuff sells. Stories sell in the country that we live in. The fourth one I wanted to talk about was cocktail party-esque. And it's what I talked about herding. We love things that other people buy. I mean, we just love stuff that everybody else buys. And then the fifth one was this element of cuteness that is very present in financial markets. I call it you're from Bombay, so you'll understand this. I've got a town, a part of town called Cuff Parade, and then I make a locality called New Cuff Parade that has nothing to do with Cuff Parade, but I sell it as New Cuff Parade. So it's just taking something and packaging it very smartly, adding some element of fanciness, and investors just fall for that. So I think these are the four or five things that you just need to watch out for as investors.
That was beautiful. You know, I think we were talking before the podcast about complexity in stories, right? So you said packaged really well, told a good story. That's one. You also have the opposite, right? Like now you have these WhatsApp forwards, you have fake news, you have all this media by your friends giving you information and no one judges it. People just believe it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I, you know, there is a lot of, as I said, the human mind has a desire to act. And today, if I'm in a bad mood or I want to spread a rumor, in the old days, I could probably affect my friends and family. Yeah. Now, you're a popular person. You can probably affect 25,000 people through WhatsApp and Twitter, etc., etc. I mean, you know, others can affect a lot. What I would tell investors is that be very careful before you make a decision on news. Do you think that the news you have, you're the first person to get it or the only person to get it? Do you really believe that in this connected world, you have some crazy information advantage? Hmm. I highly doubt. I highly doubt it. Also think of the cost of reacting. You know, someone's told you that the returns are negative in some asset class for 3 days. So you're like, okay, let me exit. And, you know, that someone has made a quick buck or got a cute point that they've made. And then a few days later, they're like, oh, no, it's all okay now. There's a huge opportunity. Then you've come back. Remember, you've probably paid exit load, taxes, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah. Think about the cost of acting on this information. Also think about, you know, I'm going to bring up one example that comes up a lot, Prateek, is this desire to pick like the thematic fund of the... So now everyone's talking about pharma fund. Like that's the story.
Correct. That's right.
Healthcare. I think investors are horrible at timing stories. By the time they realize they have to invest in a story, most of the return has gone. In fact, we did this analysis of if you invested in the best story of the year, every year from 2008 till 2018, and we did active funds, active mutual funds, you earned a return of about 10-odd%. Hmm. If you just invested in the Nifty TRI, you would get 11%.
Ah.
So I'm not saying don't do sectoral funds, but I'm saying story chasing, you really time it badly.
And all that brain power, gray matter you're using is like not really giving you an edge.
No, it's not. And you're usually late. I think stop believing that in this digital world, you have some advantage of information. You don't. The only advantage you have is really behavior.
Correct. So I guess that makes sense because if you have been told a story, I guess the people who react to a story right now, Radhika, are the same people who probably reacted to buying the good stories, the rosy stories told just a few months or a few years ago, right? So how can someone avoid reacting to the news? Just, is there a one-line answer to this?
Switch off the TV and don't be on so many WhatsApp groups. That's the only answer. And don't look at your portfolio so much.
Perfect. Let's talk about asset allocation, right? One of our favorite things to talk about. So as the basics... as the basics, Radhika, if someone's investing for the first time, what the hell is asset allocation and why should it matter to me so much?
So asset allocation is talked a lot about. It sounds very complex, but I have learned a very practical lesson about asset allocation. I mean, essentially, asset allocation is not putting all your eggs in one basket. It's like going for a meal and not just eating one thing, but consuming 2-3 different things because a balanced diet needs to have some fruit, some vegetables, some milk, some protein, etc., etc. And I think that's what asset allocation is. Now, there are lots of theories as to why it matters, but let me tell you two practical reasons why it matters. And I'm going to try and attempt to simplify this.
Yeah.
One reason that asset allocation matters is asset allocation reduces the amount of loss you earn in your portfolio. If you have a 100% equity portfolio at a time like this, you will be down 30%. You may be down 25. You may be down 32. You will be down. If you have a 50-50 equity debt portfolio, chances are you will be down 15% or something like that.
Yeah.
Now, why does that matter? I think a 15% loss for most investors is something that doesn't spook you. A 30% loss spooks you. So asset allocation, I think, cuts your losses and cutting your losses enough so that you stay in the game. I mean, investing is a long-term game. It's not such a difficult game, but it's not such an easy game either. And I think asset allocation helps you stay in the game. The other thing that asset allocation really helps with is liquidity. Now, imagine a time like this, and I've gone through this myself. I can talk about it later on the show. If you needed liquidity and you were fully invested in equities, you would be pulling out money from your equity portfolio that's down 30% and you would get irritated and you would get annoyed and you'd be like, I just lost 30% of my capital. I mean, just imagine the things. If you had some liquid assets like debt, for instance, you would be able to pull out money for what you need without worrying that that had a 30% capital loss on it. So I think these are the two practical problems that asset allocation solves for any investor.
Makes sense. I think we can't go into the depths of how to asset allocate because I think that's very personal and depending on the person's goals, etc. But basically what you're saying is that equity will go through its cycles. Debt might go through its cycles. If you can allocate between them, maybe 60, 40, 70, 30, some allocation, you can reduce that risk of when you're going down in that cycle. Is that what you meant?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you can just start with the basics of equity and debt. You don't need to get very fancy.
Makes sense. So this is what we talked about is static, right? So I have a certain allocation towards debt. I have a certain allocation towards equity. That is a static kind of asset allocation. Can you tell me what is a dynamic asset allocation and what's the pros and cons of each?
So a dynamic asset allocation is basically saying that, look, 60-40 or 50-50 at all points in time is not a great outcome. There are times when you get opportunities to invest in equity markets where you might be benefiting from being 70-30. And there are times when you should not be in equity markets because things are very fragile, etc., where you might be better off being 30-70. So a dynamic asset allocation is shifting the investments in the market. It's essentially trying to grab opportunities in the market when they're better and trying to stay away from them when things are a little rough. That's essentially what dynamic asset allocation is. And most people do dynamic asset allocation. I mean, you get the thing, and I'm probably preempting something. It's hard to do it individually, right? Because at that point, all your behavioral biases that we talked about jump in. Like most people right now would still to put in a lot of money into the market. So anyone who does dynamic asset allocation usually relies on a formula or process or something like that to do it so that the human mind is not controlling it.
Yeah, correct. And I think you did an entire course on this on LearnApp. So here's a little plug. You guys should check that out on LearnApp as well. let's talk a little bit about balanced advantage funds. So a lot of AMCs, right, Radhika, they base their asset allocation on some price to earnings of the composite of some index or the price to book of some index. And based on that, they will do a debt and equity allocation. But you guys do it a little differently. Can you talk about your approach and how you actually approach your balanced advantage funds? How are they different?
So a balanced advantage fund, as I said, is just dynamic asset allocation. And there are many ways to do dynamic asset allocation. Now, we're often taught that one kind of narrative is right. Price to book has been one approach. It's said that when valuations go up, then reduce equity exposure, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Our approach is one that looks at equity market health. I would call it trend-based analysis. So essentially what we're saying is that when markets are doing well, be invested in markets. When markets are volatile, doing badly, etc., stay away and reduce exposure. To give you a very simple analogy of how this works, if you're driving and you come across a big highway that's empty and a really high quality road, then we believe that you should pick up speed, right? The weather's good, the road's empty, etc., etc., pick up speed. However, if you're on a crowded city road with potholes like there are in Mumbai and the weather is rainy sometimes, then you should cut down your speed or cut down your exposure. That's essentially what our model tries to do. And we look at different factors. We look at how volatile the market has been. We look at how the market has performed recently. And we're quite dynamic. So I'll give you an example. In January, we had about 50-60% equity exposure because markets were quite okay. Through March, we cut it to as low as 30%. Because of the crash, I think it was the lowest equity exposure that any balanced advantage fund in the category had. And over the last week, as volatility has subsided and markets have done better, we're back up to 50-55% equity exposure. So the approach lets us be very dynamic. What it does is that in good years like 2017, you get to capture a lot of the upside. And in bad years like this, you get real protection on the downside. In moderate years, not very much happens, so we don't worry. But I think that approach works from a compounding point of view. You get the upside in the big years, you get the downside protected in the bad years. So markets fundamentally trend. I mean, markets give you 10% on average, but that average is not 10, 10, 10, 10, 10. It's plus 30, minus 20, and we're trying to capture that.
That's interesting, Radhika. I didn't know. So from January to now, you would have changed the allocation two or three times. That's interesting. And I'm guessing, coming back to our first point about AR working at Arc, it's probably completely rule-based, I'm guessing. So what are the factors?
I think your question was, what are the factors, right?
Yes. So when you say volatility, do you look at VIX? When you look at trend, how do you judge that? I mean, is there a quantitative way that you actually come down to these decisions?
Yeah. And in fact, there is a document on the model that is available on our website that actually goes through all the four factors with examples. So I truly believe in transparency of the investment process. So anyone can actually look at that. To tell you what we look at two, three things. So we look at recent performance, that's 5-day DMA, 20-day DMA, factors like that. So recent performance of the markets, in simple words. We look at market volatility. And we look at kind of how do you measure volatility? So it's not just things like VIX. Are you having a volatile market is one, Pratik, where you're having a lot of big up days and big down days. That was also 2008. So we look at things like that.
That's interesting.
And you can read the whole model. There's a document. There's a 4-page document on our website on Edelweiss MF under the balanced advantage section.
This is pretty cool. It's actually very different from a lot of AMCs as well.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the equity savings fund? So we talked about the balanced fund. Can we talk about the equity savings fund? How is it different from the balanced advantage?
So I love equity savings funds. And I have to confess, when I joined mutual funds, I was like, this is a category that has to explode. I don't know why it hasn't exploded. So balanced advantage really moves between 30 to 80% equity. On average, I would say it's 50-60. Equity savings is a lot more conservative. So your equity range is between 10 to 40. Ours is really moving around between 20 to 35 is the kind of range. Same model as the balanced advantage fund, same approach as the balanced advantage fund. So on average, you're about 20-30% equity. You're about 20-30% fixed income. And 20-30% is basic vanilla arbitrage. But the good thing is you get equity taxation on this. So I like equity savings. I think it's a great category for super conservative investors. In fact, if you look at our equity savings fund over this period, while markets are down 30%, I think the equity savings fund in its worst day was down 4-5%.
Wow, that's interesting.
At the back was down 10, equity savings was down 5. So you actually have the whole range. You have plain vanilla arbitrage. The next is equity savings. Then there's BAF, and then you move to a large cap fund. That's how I would look at it. Graded scale.
Right. And the equity savings fund has all three, right? So it has equity, it has debt, and it has arbitrage. So it sort of brings all of those things together. Nice.
Yep.
I'm moving on to a different product now. So we spoke to Dhawal, your CIO of debt, when you guys had launched the Bharat Bond ETF. And it was actually one of the most interesting and useful products out there, right? That people could actually use and start investing, and at least get started investing in bonds. So why don't you first explain what the Bharat Bond ETF is, and then I'll ask some follow-up questions.
So I'm glad you said it was useful. I think the Bharat Bond ETF is your simple debt, go-to debt product. There are two ETFs. There is one that matures in 2023 and one in 2030. And basically, both these are a packaged product that hold bonds of the best, highest rated AAA public sector enterprises, companies like NHAI and NABARD and REC and ONGC, etc., highest rated. So you really don't have to worry about credit risk. And they are all companies owned by the government of India. These products are structured to give you predictable returns if you hold them to maturity. So the 2023 holds a collection of bonds that mature in April 2023. And if you invest in them now, the yield you earn over this period is pretty predictable. So you hold the bonds till maturity. Same with the 2030. They have the benefit of indexation. So if you invest in the 3-year one right now, you get 3 indexations and you pay capital gains tax after 3 years. Same with the 10-year one. They are ETFs, which means they are tradable on the exchange. So you can buy and sell them like a stock. And remember, it's the cheapest debt product in the world. It's at less than half a basis points of expenses. So what I say about Bharat Bond is it behaves like a bond, it trades like a stock, it's diversified like a mutual fund, and it's super cheap like an ETF.
I know this is completely like Samad Seva by Edelweiss, because not only did people learn to invest in debt because of this product. I mean, Edelweiss just did it out of I give a lot of love because I think the total money you actually earned from this was just a lakh or something like that, right? So this is actually built
some absurd number
like that, which is nothing, right, to compare to get thousands of crores of people to actually start investing. Yeah. And what I liked about Bharat ETF is that the way that you can lose money, and I want to talk about that, is that if these government entities like NHAI, et cetera, default, and that the chances of that happening is extremely low, guys, when you compare it to any other debt product. So I think that you're basically investing quasi, so it's backed by the government quasi, right? Because they're PSU companies. That's what makes this pretty cool. Also a little bit about you, Radhika, let's move to that now. So you tweeted about how you personally invest. So why don't you explain how does Radhika manage her money? What's your philosophy and how do you manage your cash?
So I'm going to do this with a little story, Prateek, if that's okay, because I think personal investment is a journey and it has a context. So when I started investing, and I think this may be relevant to young investors, I started investing when I was at AQR in 2005 and 6. And obviously bonuses were great at that time on Wall Street. So I went 100% equities at that time. And, you know, 6 and 7 were great years and it was all good. Then 8 came. And the reason I did 100% equities was like, you know, the classic, I am a young person, so I should take risk. And, you know, that 100 minus 8 kind of all that stuff. So 8 happened. Equity portfolio was down 50%. Worked for AQR. Obviously, fund AUMs were down. Fund returns were bad. Bonuses were really bad. Plus my husband worked for Goldman. So he was the same thing. Plus 100% equities, plus his ESOPs got hammered. So essentially Radhika plus husband, Radhika as a family, is like a 3x levered bet on markets.
On markets.
And it was a horrible. I mean, I'm just writing an article about this. I was distraught. And then we had to come back to India in 2009. And I actually withdrew a lot of money at cuts. And then I realized that, you know, and I want to tell young people this, not every young person is 100% equity person, because finance depends on your personal circumstances. There is no one right answer. They say that in personal finance, the word personal comes before finance, and I can't agree more. So then I realized as a pharma professional, this outcome would be very different. So I have 70% of my money in balanced advantage funds, which we spoke about. I use the Edelweiss balanced advantage fund. The rest of the 30% of my money is in equities. It's largely mid and small cap equities. And I have some money in international equities as part of that, because I've always been a big believer of diversification and other asset classes. People may ask why I don't have debt. I have debt through the balanced advantage fund. I also have a home loan, so earning 7% on debt doesn't make sense. You'd rather pay off your home loan at this point in time. If I had to do debt, I would buy the Bharat Bond ETF for 3-year plus debt, and I would buy arbitrage funds for short-term debt if I do have debt. Whenever I have any kind of short-term capital, I use arbitrage funds for that. I'm a salaried professional, so I do SIPs, and I keep adding to this asset allocation through SIPs. So that's essentially what I am. I mean, I'm 40% debt if you count my balanced advantage holdings, 50-60% equities, which includes international equities, all mutual funds, no direct stocks. And I have a primary home that I've bought and that's under construction, and I have ESOPs. So that's me.
That's the thing. Interesting. Radhika, this, if you have some free cash free cash for savings, I'm saying from the salary that you get, you don't put any of that into like a liquid fund or something, or that's not needed as of now?
If I do have a little free cash, then yes, liquid funds. If the duration is over 1 month, then arbitrage funds.
Excellent. So let's move on. What are your favorite investors that you admire the most? Any names you could give us?
So I actually don't want to give you names. I want to just continue that, because I believe that, you know, when we give names, and I don't want to take away anything from anyone who is a very successful investor. So someone once asked me, when I told them about my personal investing story that I told you, that what would Warren Buffett think of how you manage your money? Because he says hold equities for the long term. And I said, with all due respect to him, it doesn't matter what he thinks, because his circumstances are not the same as my circumstances. And I think investing is not such a complex thing that we need to have huge role models. We just need to follow good principles and manage our money and do what is right for us. So while there are lots of people I admire, I don't have an investing role model. I think just, I've been a big believer, you know, even personally, that you are unique and different and you have to manage to your own personality. And I think your financial personality is unique and different and you have to manage that. As an asset management professional, I adore Cliff. And I adore him just because he's very honest and he speaks his mind. I don't think we do enough of that in our industry. I'm trying to become more honest and speak my mind. So I adore Cliff for that. And I adore his blend of academia, and he's still a child at heart. So I think I love that aspect of an asset management CEO.
Of Warren Buffett saying about circumstance, I mean, that couldn't be truer, because at least I can say this. Warren Buffett says that you should hold on to investments forever, but that's not true. We have seen investments where he's completely exited. So you're completely right by saying the circumstance for everyone is different. So I guess that makes total sense. So you guys publish actually some really cool book summaries, Radhika, on the Edelweiss site. And we'll add a link in the show notes before so everyone can check that out. Please do that. What are some must-read books? Recommend me some books for traders and investors.
I will give you three books, and they're a mix. One is called, it's a financial history book, unconventional one. It's called A Piece of the Action. And it talks about sort of the whole mutual fund movement in the US, the whole credit movement in the US, credit cards. It gives you financial history. You will find many analogs to India and how India's market is kind of moving and developing as a financial market. So you'll really enjoy that. It is a good time to read Mr. Taleb's The Black Swan, if you haven't read it, or if investors haven't read it. So please, we have a book summary on Black Swan. If you can't read the whole book, it's a hard book to read. Check out the. And the third one, which I think every investor should read, is a book, the book Thaler's Nudge. It's a book that talks about behavioral biases, but rather than just talking about biases, it talks about the small principles that you can implement to make sure that you're not hit by the biases. So it's called Nudge. We've got videos also of it. You know, we do small summary videos on it on our YouTube page. So you can check that out. But the summary is also on our website.
Excellent. Thank you so much for doing this. And listeners, if you enjoy this podcast and you made it through 1 hour of this, please tweet to Radhika, tweet to LearnApp, tweet to Zerodha, and tell us if you enjoyed this podcast or not. Thank you so much, Radhika.
Thank you so much.
This conversation is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as investment advice. Mutual fund investments are subject to market risks. Read all scheme-related documents carefully. Please consult your financial advisors before making investments.